how are these men portrayed in the dark romance novels, and why are women drawn to that from an evolutionary perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for all that today you hear a lot of discussion of things like toxic masculinity, the reality is that women are attracted to men who are masculine. That's kind of what it means to say that you're attracted to men, right? That you're attracted to things that are indicators of masculinity. And many of the things like being physically strong or being assertive are things that lead to success in physical competition, but also in terms of like workplace and status competition, right? Which doesn't mean that the guy goes into the workplace and punches somebody in the face, but he has a sense of assertiveness, right? Like there are guys when they walk into a room, you just have a feeling that that guy, like if things went south, this is somebody who would be, you know, whether they were physically or whether they were, you know, psychologically capable person, right? And those are men that women would have historically found attractive because they would have been good protectors, good dads, good social ties, writers. I think women still find those men attractive. Now, that doesn't mean they want somebody who's going to grab them by the hair and drag them around the room. They want somebody who's going to do that to anybody who threatens them or their children. But they also want a guy who's going to be loving and caring towards them and their children. And so a lot of times when you think about dark romance or the appeal of vampires or any of these kinds of fictional, you know, sort of tropes, a huge part of it is that these males are like, you know, in a sense, almost mesmerized by the female, the heroine in those stories. Like they can't control their own desire to have her, their attraction to her, but it's also partially their commitment to her, right? And so for many women, that I think is very appealing, the idea that there's something about you that is particularly special to a guy that is also highly desirable, right? And so I think that's part of it. And I think that, you know, the more we've seen society sort of, you know, sort of downgrade certain aspects of masculinity, yet female genres have elevated that at the same time. You can even think about it in really odd sort of situations. Like think about the popularity of characters like Dexter. One might have once thought that characters like, you know, serial killers would be of interest to men more than women. But a serial killer who kills the bad guys seems to be very appealing to women. But again, that's like a predator that is going to be a good protector at the same time, right? And I think in, especially when women might perceive their environment as more threatening, they may be especially attracted to those kind of males. And there, I think there's some data from some studies that were done a number of years ago. It was Carlos Navarrete and maybe Dan Fessler did some work showing that women in more violent neighborhoods, for example, I think they might have done some of the work here in California, but women who were living in more violent neighborhoods actually valued male physical prowess and aggressiveness more in a partner. And it's because you actually need it more in those environments, right? And so again, as pointing out, I think one of the things that also is really good to keep in mind, again, when we mentioned it earlier, right, when we think about evolutionary explanations, you have mechanisms, right, psychological mechanisms that shape stuff, but they're sensitive to the environment. And women in really benign environments might not value that as much as women who are living in environments where it might be more beneficial to them.
Yeah. Do nice guys always finish last?
I don't think that's true. I mean, I think that you can be too nice, right? And I think that you can be too nasty, right? I mean, I think this goes back to discussions of things like health as well, right? Like the extremes are not always the ideal in many ways. I think that you do not want to be so nice that you're taken advantage of, right? By your friends, by your family, by your partner. But you also don't want to be so harsh that you're unattractive as a partner or as a social, you know, as a friend, right, or a social ally. There is a balance to be had in terms of being generous and you know, being seen as generous by your partner and by your friends, and being seen as somebody who can be taken advantage of and walked on. I don't think it's that nice guys finish last. I think it's that there's a risk to being, to not discriminating in your own interactions with other people, right? And actually, thinking about that in terms of larger applications, I mean, people like Gadsad have talked about what he calls suicidal empathy, right? That you can be too nice, and this can be a problem, right? If you're so nice that you let people come into your home and they take advantage of you or whatever, that's a problem. But the opposite extreme is also. So yeah. I think if we think about the social environment in which humans evolve, we did evolve for small group interactions. I think one of the challenges is that in small group interactions, everybody knows everybody, reputation gets spread amongst the group, right? And so it's safe to be a nice guy because you know who the people are that are problems and you know who the people are who are nice guys, right? It works out really well. In the modern world, we don't always have that same kind of information, and you can't always trust the information that you get on social media about stuff like that anyways. But the bigger the city, the less people that you see that you know very much about, the easier it is to get taken advantage of, and the easier it is for people to take on those sort of predatory strategies and get away with it. So it makes it a more challenging problem to solve, I think.
Yeah. And do you know what causes someone to be a nice guy from their upbringing or genetics, and why, what are some evolutionary reasons for why it can be seen as less attractive?
Well, I think there's probably a combination of things. I don't know that anybody has a really great assessment of how much of people's like altruistic or nice guy nature is due to genes versus due to the upbringing versus due to the environment that they're in. Circumstances also play a role in that. I mean, there is, so I can give you one little tiny bit, because this is one of the only little tiny bits I know much about in that area, is that birth order is one of those things that seems to influence a little bit, that middle children seem to be a little bit more empathetic. I think it's actually the most recent thing that I'd ever published that dealt with birth order stuff, because I did a lot of that really early on in my career and a lot less of it more recently. But I've been interested in looking at people's attitudes towards animals and things that influence their treatment of animals. And middle children it's a small effect, but they do seem to be a bit more empathetic towards them, especially domestic animals, and how they're treated. So, I mean, I think there are some interesting sort of early environment things that can influence that. But I think there are some things that are probably genetic, right? Like if you think about people who have really like dark triad, like psychopaths and things like that, I think a lot of that probably is genetic, and probably relatively little of it is environment, right? There's all sorts of examples that we can think of people who have those kinds of tendencies, who've done horrible things and grew up in completely normal families. But there are also some that grew up in dysfunctional families, right? And so again, it's really difficult to parse some of that stuff out. In terms of why people would be kind and nice and cooperative, again, it's like we evolved in small groups. Cooperation matters, right? It's like the ability to get along with people, to form social groups. That kind of support is really important to us, right? And it would have been important historically, whether we're living on the savannah or wherever. But it's also important now. People who have really strong social networks have better mental health. They've got people who are able to support them if things happen, somebody loses a job, somebody suffers a relationship breakup. You have social support, and that is a huge difference. But you only have social support if you're cooperative, right? If you're altruistic with your own friends. And so I think we have very significant adaptations to encourage cooperation within our own social groups. Now, people who extend their altruism towards people they don't even know, that is, I think, a larger, interesting question, right, about what motivates people. And some people have talked about it being like a like an advertisement, right? If I'm really good to people in general, then I'm the kind of nice person that other people should want to be friends with, right? It could be an advertisement. And that could be an honest advertisement, or it could be a dishonest advertisement, right?
Can be often a dishonest one.
They're usually talking about a dishonest signal. But it can be an honest signal as well, right? And there could be reasons for people motivated to do those kinds of things. Understanding why people do this and what shapes people doing this in the absence of any social benefit is a different question. But like, you know, you could imagine looking at people who are philanthropic and give big donations to places. And very often they have buildings named after them. But there are also people who make big donations and don't make it public, or they do them anonymously. And there's probably something different going on in those cases, right? Because there's a benefit that is very clear in one of them, and the benefit in the other one is less clear. Although it may be that we are just designed, right, to be cooperative in and altruistic in, with these small groups, and that in the modern world, sometimes in a sense, maybe it misfunctions and we are altruistic towards people more broadly, right? Just because it feels good to us, right? Like if you do something nice for somebody, it may have originally, you know, evolved because everybody that you lived with was part of a group, but even now you still behave that way in the modern world, even though, you know, you don't know anybody, you're holding the door open for somebody, not because there's a benefit to you, but because, you know, that's just what you do to people in your community, right? You're nice to people that you interact with. Then we extend it to a broader range of individuals now.
Yeah. And if you're on a first date, if you compare the maybe, well, I say nice guy, but just the less assertive, less confident, maybe the anxious guy versus not the complete opposite like we've been discussing, but the more assertive, the slightly more dominant, the slightly more kind of charismatic man, why would the more charismatic man tend to probably have a better success on that first date? What does it signal from an evolutionary perspective if you're a bit more assertive, a bit less anxious and
right? Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that might signal. I mean, one of the things that it might signal is just status, right? Whether that status is achieved through dominance or prestige, either way, if your confidence is signaling status, it's signaling ability to acquire resources, ability to be a provider in that way. I mean, some of it can just be that. If you think about the range of things that people might be advertising in terms of mating, it, you know, again, good genes, physical strength, attractiveness, resource acquisition abilities. And the resource acquisition abilities, sometimes when people are younger, right, you don't have a lot of resources yet, you're still in college, whatever. But you may give signs of traits that are associated with the ability to acquire them, which would include things like confidence and assertiveness and things like that. And so I suspect that a lot of it is that it's like that we're sort of tracking whatever translates to status in our own communities, right? And because the status is what led to resources, you know, over historical time. And so today's for somebody that might be just money or things like the kind of car guy drives or whatever. But that wouldn't have been what it would have been historically, right? It would have been things like being confident, being assertive, and, you know, being, you know, able to provide dinner, whether you went out, killed it or and cooked it yourself, or whether you took somebody to a nice place to eat. There's a variety of ways in which people can sort of demonstrate capabilities that are important. So I suspect that's why, or at least that's one of the reasons why confidence is something that's seen as being attractive. I mean, I suspect there probably is a little bit of a sweet spot between not wanting to seem overconfident and not being too anxious, right? Like if you're too anxious, then you might be thinking that the guy's high in neuroticism, which is generally a little bit concerning. But you don't want him to be so overconfident that like he gives off asshole vibes, right? there's a sweet spot between those extremes.
And how does overconfidence, how does that, from an evolutionary perspective, make you less attractive? Is it because you'll have a higher chance of being kicked out of the tribe if you're a bit of an asshole?
Well, I mean, it could, but I think it also could be more that for women, it might, like, I don't, it may not, the only reason, like, so from the male perspective, somebody, another guy who's overconfident, it only matters if it's an overestimation of his actual abilities. If he really is as good as he thinks he is, then you want him to be your buddy, you know, and to be part of your group, because that's a benefit to the mobility or the success of your group. From a female perspective, the one risk with men who see themselves as very high in mate value is they often are less faithful partners. If they have lots of other ways of diverting their resources to other matings. And so again, I think women's own mate value may influence how they perceive that. If she's really confident that she's a 10, maybe she's okay with that. But the average woman is probably going to be okay. Is he, you know, there's going to be some of this waiting. Is he so much, you know, overinflated sense of self, whatever, that he's going to cheat, right? And I think that is a risk. Because the cheating for men is more than being associated with their attractiveness. It tends to be associated with their status, right? Really high status men, you know, often are more likely to be, you know, committed to fidelity. And so I think that women who are interested in long-term mating are going to care about that. If all she wants is a short-term fling, maybe she doesn't care. And maybe it's really attractive. But I think if she's interested in the long-term, that can be a problem.